Mel slept at my place last night since he was the worse for wear after he met me at the bayou. So early this morning, there was a knock at the door. I answered it, and this guy was there, and he was, I don't know, nuts or something. The strangest part was, this guy looked a lot like me. Oh, no, I sat on the stool abruptly. It wasn't right, sis, Jason said. I don't know what was wrong with him, but he wasn't right. He just started talking when Mel answered the door, like we knew who he was. He was saying crazy stuff. Mel tried to get between him and me, and he threw Mel clear across the room and called him a killer. Mel might have broken his neck if he hadn't landed on the couch.
Mel's okay, then.
Yeah, he's okay. Pretty mad, but you know...
Sure.
Mel's feelings were not the most important issue here.
So what did he do next?
He said some shit about now that he was face to face with me, he could see why my great-grandfather didn't want me around, and crossbreeds should all die. But I was clearly blood of his blood, and he decided I should know what's going on around me. He said I was ignorant. I didn't understand a lot of it, and I still don't get what he was. He wasn't a vamp, and I know he wasn't a shifter of any kind, or I'd have smelled him.
You're okay. That's the big thing, right?
Had I been wrong all along about keeping Jason out of the fairy loop?
Yeah, he said, his voice abruptly going all cautious and wary. You're not going to tell me what this is all about, are you?
Come over here and we'll talk about it. Please, please don't open the door unless you know who's there. This guy is bad, Jason, and he's not picky about who he hurts. I think you and Mel were real lucky.
You got someone there with you?
Not since Trey left.
I'm your brother. I'll come over if you need me,
Jason said with unexpected dignity. I really appreciate that, I said.
I got two for the price of one. Mal came with Jason. This was awkward because I had some family stuff to tell Jason and I couldn't with Mal around.
With unexpected tact, Mal told Jason that he had to run home and get an ice pack for his shoulder, which was badly bruised. While Mal was gone, I sat Jason down on the other side of the kitchen table, and I said, I got some things to tell you.
About Crystal?
No, I haven't heard anything about that yet. This is about us. This is about Gran. You're gonna have a hard time believing this.
I'd given him fair warning. I remembered how upset I'd been when my great-grandfather had told me about how my half-fairy grandfather, Fintan, had met my grandmother, and how she'd ended up having two children with him, our dad and our Aunt Linda. Now, Fintan was dead, murdered, and our grandmother was dead, and our father and his sister were dead. But we were living, and just a small part fairy, and that made us a target for our great-grandfather's enemies.
And one of those enemies, I said after I told him our family history, is our half-human great-uncle, Fintan's brother, Dermot. He told Trey and Amelia that his name was Drake, I guess because it sounded more modern. Dermot looks like you, and he's the one who showed up at your house. I don't know what his deal is. He joined up with Brendan, Niall's big enemy, even though he's half-human himself, and therefore exactly what Brendan hates. So when you said he was crazy, I guess there's your explanation. He seems to want to connect with you, but he hates you, too.
Jason sat staring at me. His face was completely vacant. His thoughts had gotten caught in a traffic jam. Finally, he said,
You tell me he was trying to get Trey and Amelia to introduce you, and neither of them knew what he was?
I nodded. There was some more silence.
So why did he want to meet you? Did he want to kill you? Why'd he need to meet you first?
Good question. I don't know, I said. Maybe he just wanted to see what I was like. Maybe he doesn't know what he really wants.
I couldn't figure this out. And I wondered if Niall would come back to explain it to me. Probably not. He had a war on his hands, even if it was a war being fought mostly away from human view.
I don't get it, I said out loud.
Murray came right here to attack me, and he was all fairy. Why is Dermot, who's on the same side, being all indirect?
Murray? Jason asked, and I closed my eyes. Shit.
He was a fairy, I said. He tried to kill me. He's not a problem now.
Jason gave me an approving nod.
You go, Sookie, he said. Okay, let me see if I'm getting this straight. My great-grandfather didn't want to meet me because I look a lot like Dermot, who's my great-uncle, right?
Right.
But Dermot apparently likes me a little better because he actually came to my house and tried to talk to me.
Trust Jason to interpret the situation in those terms.
Right, I said. Jason hopped to his feet and took a turn around the kitchen.
This is all the vampire's fault, he said.
He glared at me.
Why do you think so? This was unexpected.
If they hadn't come out, none of this would be happening. Look at what's happened since they went on TV. Look at how the world has changed. Now we're out, next the fucking fairies, and the fae are bad news, Sookie. Calvin warned me about them. You think they're all pretty and sweetness and light, but they're not. He told me stories about them that would make your hair curl. Calvin's dad knew a fairy or two. From what he said, it would be a good thing if they died out.
I couldn't decide if I was surprised or angry. Why are you being so mean, Jason? I don't need you arguing with me or saying bad things about Niall. You don't know him. You don't... Hey, you're part fairy, remember?
I had an awful feeling that some of what he'd said was absolutely true, but it sure wasn't the time to have this discussion. Jason looked grim, every plane of his face tense.
I'm not claiming kin to any fairy, he said. He don't want me, I don't want him. And if I see that crazy half and half again, I'll kill the son of a bitch.
I don't know what I would have said, but at that moment, Mel came in without knocking, and we both turned to look at him.
I'm sorry, he said,
obviously flustered and disturbed by Jason's anger. He seemed, for a second, to think Jason had been talking about him. When neither of us gave him a guilty reaction, he relaxed.
Excuse me, Sookie, I forgot my manners.
He was carrying an ice bag in his hand, and he was moving a little slowly and painfully.
I'm sorry you got hurt by Jason's surprise visitor, I said. You're always supposed to put your company at ease. I hadn't put a whole lot of thought into Mel, but right at that second, I realized I would have been happier if Jason's former BFF Hoyt had been here instead of the Werepanther. It wasn't that I disliked Mel, I thought. It was just that I didn't know him very well, and I didn't feel an automatic trust in him the way you feel about people from time to time. Mel was different. Even for a Werepanther, he was hard to read, but that didn't mean he was impossible. After offering Mel something to drink, which was only polite, I asked Jason if he was going to stay the day, run around on my errands with me. I had serious doubts he would say yes. Jason was feeling rejected by a fairy great-grandfather he'd never met and didn't want to acknowledge, and that was a state of affairs Jason didn't handle well.
I'll go around with you, he said, unsmiling and stiff. First, let me run over to the house and check out my rifle. I'll need it, and it hasn't been sighted in a coon's age. Mel? You coming with me?
Jason simply wanted to be out of my presence to calm down. I could read it as easily as if he'd written it on the grocery list pad by the telephone. Mel rose to go with Jason.
Mel, what did you make of Jason's visitor this morning? I asked.
Aside from the fact that he could throw me across the room and looked enough like Jason to make me turn to make sure your brother was coming out of his bedroom, not much, Mel said.
Mal had managed to dress in his usual khakis and polo shirt, but the blue bruises on his arms kind of ruined his neat appearance. He shrugged on a jacket with great care.
See you in a while, Sookie. Come around to get me, Jason said.
Of course, he'd want to ride in my car and burn up my gas since we were running my errands.
In the meantime, you got my cell number.
Sure, I'll see you in an hour or so.
Since being alone hadn't been a normal state of affairs for me lately, I would have actually enjoyed the feeling of having the house to myself
if I hadn't been worried that a supernatural killer was after me. Nothing happened. I ate a bowl of cereal. Finally, I decided to risk taking a shower, despite my psycho memories. I made sure all the outside doors were locked, and I locked the bathroom door, too. I took the quickest shower on record. Nobody had tried to kill me yet. I dried off, put on some makeup, and dressed for work. When it was time to go, I stood on the back porch and eyeballed the distance between the steps and my car door over and over. I figured I'd have to take 10 steps. I unlocked the car with the keypad. I took a few deep breaths and unlocked the screen door. I pushed it open and fairly leaped off the porch, bypassing the steps entirely. In an undignified scramble, I yanked open the car door, slid inside, and slammed and locked the door. I looked around me. Nothing moved. I laughed a little breathlessly. Silly me. Being so tense was making all the scary movies I'd ever seen pop into my head. I was thinking of Jurassic Park and dinosaurs. Maybe my thought link was that fairies were the dinosaurs of the supernatural world, and I half expected a piece of goat to fall on my windshield. That didn't happen either. Okay. I inserted the key and turned it, and the motor turned over. I didn't blow up. There was no Tyrannosaurus in my rearview mirror. So far, so good. I felt better once I'd begun going slowly down the driveway through the woods, but I was sure keeping my eyes busy. I felt a compulsion to get in touch with someone, to let someone know where I was and what I was doing. I whipped my cell phone out of my purse and called Amelia. When she answered, I said, "I'm driving over to Jason's. Since Trey is so sick, Jason's going around with me today. Listen, you know Trey was spelled by a fairy into drinking rotten vampire blood?" "I'm at work here," Amelia said, caution in her voice. "Yes, he called 10 minutes ago, but he had to go throw up. Poor Trey. At least the house was okay." Amelia's point was that her wards had held. Well, she had a right to be proud of that. "You're great," I said. "Thanks. Listen, I'm really worried about Trey. I tried calling him back after a few minutes, but he didn't answer. I hope he's just sleeping it off, but I'm going over there after I leave work. Why don't you meet me there? We can figure out what to do about getting you some more security." "Okay," I said. "I'll come right over after I get off work, probably around 5. Phone in my hand, I jumped out and grabbed the mail from my mailbox, which sat up on Hummingbird Road. Then I got back in my car quick as I could. That had been stupid. I could have gone without checking the mail for one day. Habits are very hard to break, even when they're unimportant habits. "I really am lucky you live with me, Amelia," I said. That might have been spreading it on a little thick, but it was the absolute truth. But Amelia had gone off on another mental path. "You're speaking to Jason again? You told him? About things?" "Yeah, I had to. Great-grandfather can't have everything his own way. Stuff has happened." "It always does around you," Amelia said. She didn't sound angry, and she wasn't condemning me. "Not always," I said, after a sharp moment of doubt. "In fact," I thought, as I turned left at the end of Hummingbird Road to go to my brother's, "that point Jason made about everything changing when the vamps came out, that just might have been something I really agree with." Prosaically, I realized my car was almost out of gas. I had to pull in to grab it quick. While I was pumping the liquid gold into my car, I fell back to puzzling over what Jason had told me. What would be urgent enough to bring a reclusive and human-hating half-fairy to Jason's door? Why would he tell Jason? I shouldn't be thinking about this. This was stupid, and I should be watching out for myself instead of trying to solve Jason's problems. But after a few more seconds of turning the conversation over in my head, I began to have a sneaking suspicion that I understood it a little better. I called Calvin. At first, he didn't get what I was saying, but then he agreed to meet me at Jason's house. I caught a glimpse of Jason in the backyard when I pulled into the circular driveway of the neat, small house my dad had built when he and my mother were first married. It was out in the country, out farther west than Arlene's trailer, and though it was visible from the road, it had a pond and several acres lying behind it. My dad had loved to hunt and fish, and my brother did too. Jason had recently put in a makeshift range, and I could hear the rifle. I decided to come through the house, and I took care to yell when I was at the back door. "Hey," Jason called back. He had a .30-30 in his hands. It had been our father's. Mel was standing behind him, holding a box of ammo. "We decided we'd better get in some practice."
"Good idea. I wanted to be sure you didn't think I was your crazy caller, come back to yell some more."
Jason laughed. "I still don't understand what good Dermot thought he'd do coming up to the front door like that."
"I think I do," I said.
Jason held out his hand without looking, and Mal gave him some bullets. Jason opened the rifle and began loading. I looked over at the sawhorse he'd set up, noted all the empty milk jugs lying on the ground. He'd filled them with water so they'd sit steady, and thanks to the bullet holes, the water was flowing out onto the ground.
"Good shooting," I said. I took a deep breath. "Hey, Mel, you want to tell me about hot shot funerals? I haven't ever been to one, and Crystal's will take place as soon as the body comes back, I reckon."
Mel looked a little surprised.
"You know I haven't lived out there for years," he protested. "It's just not for me."
Except for the fading bruises, he didn't look like he'd been thrown across the room by anyone, much less a crazed half-fairy.
"I wonder why that guy threw you around instead of Jason," I said, and felt Mel's thoughts ripple with fear. "Are you hurt?"
He moved his right shoulder a little.
"I thought I'd broken something, but I guess it's just gonna be sore. I wonder what he was. Not one of us."
He hadn't answered my question, I noticed. Jason looked proud that he hadn't blabbed.
"He's not entirely human," I said.
Mal looked relieved.
"Well, that's good to know," he said. "My pride was pretty much shot to hell when he threw me around. I mean, I'm a full-blood panther, and it was like I was kindling or something."
Jason laughed.
"I thought he'd come on in and kill me then, thought I was a goner. But once Mel was down, this guy just started talking to me. Mel was playing possum, and here's this fella looks a lot like me, telling me what a favor he's done me."
"It was weird," Mal agreed, but he looked uncomfortable.
"You know I'd have been on my feet if he started punching on you, but he really rang my bell, and I figured I might as well stay down once it looked like he wasn't going to go after you."
"Mal, I hope you're really okay."
I made my voice concerned, and I moved a little closer.
"Let me have a look at that shoulder."
I extended my hand, and Jason's eyebrows knit together.
"Why do you need to—"
An awful suspicion was creeping over his face. Without another word, he stepped behind his friend and held him firm, his hands gripping Mel on either side right below Mel's shoulders. Mel winced with pain, but he didn't say anything, not a word. He didn't even pretend to be indignant or surprised, and that was almost enough. I put a hand on either side of Mel's face, and I closed my eyes, and I looked in his head. And this time, Mel was thinking about Crystal, not Jason.
"He did it,"
I said. I opened my eyes and looked at my brother's face across Mel's shoulder. I nodded. Jason screamed, and it wasn't a human sound. Mel's face seemed to melt, as if all the muscles and bones had shifted. He hardly looked human at all.
"Let me look at you," Mel pleaded.
Jason looked confused, since Mel was looking at me. He couldn't look anywhere else, the way Jason was holding him. Mel wasn't struggling, but I could see every muscle under his skin standing out, and I didn't think he'd be passive forever. I bent down and picked up the rifle, glad Jason had reloaded it.
"He wants to look at you, not me," I told my brother.
"God damn it,"
Jason said. His breathing was heavy and ragged, as if he'd been running, and his eyes were wide.
"You have to tell me why."
I stepped back and raised the rifle. At this distance, even I couldn't miss.
Turn him around, since he wants to talk to you face to face.
They were in profile to me when Jason spun Mel around. Jason's grip refastened on the Werepanther, but now Jason's face was a foot from Mel's. Calvin walked around the house. Crystal's sister, Dawn, was with him. There was also a boy of about 15 trailing along. I remembered meeting the boy at the wedding. He was Jackie, Crystal's oldest first cousin. Adolescents practically reek of emotion and confusion, and Jackie was no exception. He was struggling to conceal the fact that he was both nervous and excited. Maintaining a cool demeanor was just killing him. The three newcomers took in the scene. Calvin shook his head, his face solemn.
"This is a bad day,"
he said quietly, and Mel jerked at the sound of his leader's voice. Some of the tension leaked out of Jason when he saw the other Werepanthers.
"Suki says he did it," he said to Calvin.
"That's good enough for me," Calvin said. "But Mel, you should tell us yourself, brother."
"I'm not your brother," Mel said bitterly. "I haven't lived with you for years."
"That was your own choice,"
Calvin said. He walked around so he could see Mel's face, and the other two followed him. Jackie was snarling. Any pretense at being cool had vanished. The animal was showing through.
"There isn't anyone else in Hotshot like me. I would have been alone."
Jason looked blank.
"There are lots of guys in Hotshot like you," he said.
"No, Jason," I said. "Mel's gay."
"We're not okay with that?"
my brother asked Calvin. Jason hadn't yet gotten the party line on a few issues, apparently.
"We're okay with people doing what they want to do in bed after they've done their duty to the clan," Calvin said. "Purebred males have to father a youngin' no matter what."
"I couldn't do it," Mal said. "I just plain couldn't do it."
"But you were married once," I said, and wished I hadn't spoken. This was a matter for the clan now.
I hadn't called Bud Dearborn, I'd called Calvin. My word was good enough for Calvin, not for court.
"Our marriage didn't work in that department," Mal said.
His voice sounded almost normal.
"Which was okay with her. She had her own fish to fry. We never had conventional sex."
If I found this distressing, I could only imagine how hard it had been for Mel. But when I remembered what Crystal had looked like up on that cross, all my sympathy drained away in a hurry.
"Why did you do that to Crystal?" I asked.
I could tell from the rage building in the brains around me that the time for talking was almost over. Mel looked beyond me, past my brother, away from his leader, his victim's sister and cousin. He seemed to be focused on the winter bare limbs of the trees around the still, brown pond.
"I love Jason," he said. "I love him, and she abused him and his child. Then she taunted me. She came here that day. I'd stopped off to get Jason to help me build some shelves at the shop, but he wasn't here. She drove up while I was out in the yard, writing Jason a note. She began to say, she said awful things. Then she told me I had to have sex with her, that if I did, she'd tell them at Hotshot, and I'd be able to go back to live there, and Jason could come live with me. She said, 'His baby's inside me, doesn't that get you all hot?' And it got worse and worse. The bed of the truck was down because the wood I'd bought was sticking out, and she kind of backed up to it and lay down, and I could see her. She kept telling me what a pussy I was, and that Jason would never care about me, and I slapped her as hard as I could."
Dawn Norris turned to one side as though she was going to throw up, but she pressed her lips together in a hard line and straightened up. Jackie wasn't that tough.
She wasn't dead, though. My brother forced the words between his clenched teeth. She bled all down the cross. She lost the baby after she'd been hung up.
I'm sorry about that, Mel said. His gaze returned from the pond and the trees and focused on my brother. I thought the blow had killed her. I really did. I would never have left her to go in the house if I'd thought she was still alive. I would never have let someone else get her. What I did was bad enough because I intended for her to die, but I didn't crucify her. Please believe me. No matter what you think of me for hurting her, I would never have done that. I thought if I took her somewhere else, no one would think you did it. I knew you were going out that night, and I figured if I put her somewhere else, you'd have an alibi. I figured you'd end up spending the night with Michelle.
Mel smiled at Jason, and it was such a tender look that my heart ached.
So I left her in the back of the truck, and I came in the house to have a drink. And when I came back out, she was gone. I couldn't believe it. I thought she'd gotten up and walked away, but there wasn't any blood, and the wood was gone too.
Why, Merlotz,
Calvin said, and his voice came out like a growl.
I don't know, Calvin, Mel said.
His face was almost sublime with his relief from the load of his guilt, with the release of confessing his crime and his love for my brother.
Calvin, I know I'm about to die, and I swear to you that I have no idea what happened to Crystal after I went into the house. I did not do that horrible thing to her.
I don't know what to make of that, Calvin said, but we have your confession, and we'll have to proceed.
I accept that, Mal said. Jason, I love you.
Dawn turned her head just a fraction so her eyes could meet mine. You better go, she said. We got things to do. I walked off with the rifle, and I didn't turn to look even when the other panthers began to tear Mel apart. I could hear it, though. He didn't scream after a second. I left Jason's rifle on his back porch, and I drove to work. Somehow, having a bodyguard didn't seem important anymore. Chapter 16. As I served beers and daiquiris and vodka Collinses to the people stopping by on their way home from work, I stood back and eyed myself in amazement. I'd worked for hours, serving and smiling and hustling, and I'd never broken down at all. Sure, I'd had to ask four people to repeat their orders, and I'd walked past Sam twice, and he'd said something to me to which I hadn't responded. I knew this because he'd stopped me to tell me so. But I'd gotten the right plates and drinks to the right tables, and my tips were running about average, which meant I'd been agreeable and hadn't forgotten anything crucial.
You're doing so good, I told myself. I'm so proud of you. You just have to get through this. You can go home in 15 minutes.
I wondered how many women had given themselves the same lecture. The girl who'd held up her head at a dance where her date was paying attention to another classmate. The woman who'd been passed by for promotion at her job. The woman who had listened to a dire diagnosis and yet kept her face together. I knew men must have days like this, too. Well, maybe not too many people had days exactly like this. Naturally, I'd been turning over in my head Mel's strange insistence that he was not responsible for Crystal's crucifixion, during which she'd actually died. His thoughts had had the ring of truth, and really, there was no reason why he would have balked at confessing everything when he'd already confessed so much, found peace doing so. Why would someone steal the half-dead Crystal and the wood and do a deed so disgusting? It would have had to have been someone who'd hated Crystal an awful lot, or maybe someone who had hated Mel or Jason. It was an inhuman act, yet I found myself believing in Mel's dying assertion that he had not done it. I was so glad to leave work that I began driving home on automatic pilot. When I'd gotten almost to the turnoff into my driveway, I remembered that I'd told Amelia hours before that I'd meet her at Trey's house. I'd completely forgotten. I could forgive myself, considering the day I'd had, if Amelia was okay. But when I remembered Trey's mean state and his ingestion of vampire blood, I felt a jolt of panic. I looked at my watch and saw I was more than 45 minutes late. Turning around in the next driveway, I drove back to town like a bat out of hell. I was trying to pretend to myself I wasn't scared. I wasn't doing a very good job. There weren't any cars in front of the small house. Its windows were dark. I could see the bumper of Trey's truck peering out from the carport behind the house. I drove right by and turned around on a county road about half a mile farther out. Confused and worried, I returned to park outside Trey's. His house and the adjacent workshop were outside the Bon Ton city limits, but not isolated. Trey had maybe a half-acre lot. His little home and the large metal building housing his repair business were right next to a similar setup owned by Brock and Chessie Johnson, who had an upholstery shop. Obviously, Brock and Chessie had retreated to their house for the night. The living room lights were on. As I watched, Chessie pulled the curtains shut, which most people out here didn't bother to do. The night was dark and quiet. The Johnson's dog was barking, but that was the only sound. It was too cold for the chorus of bugs that often made the night come alive. I thought of several scenarios that could explain the dead look of the house. One, the vampire blood still had hold over Trey, and he'd killed Amelia. Right now, he was in his house, in the dark, thinking of ways to kill himself. Or maybe he was waiting for me to come so he could kill me, too. Two, Trey had recovered from his ingestion of vamp blood, and when Amelia had appeared on his doorstep, they decided to treat their free afternoon as a honeymoon. They wouldn't be at all happy if I interrupted them. Three, Amelia had come by, found no one at home, and was now back at the house cooking supper for herself and me because she expected me to drive up at any moment. At least that explanation accounted for the absence of Amelia's car. I tried to think of an even better series of events, but I couldn't. I pulled out my cell phone and tried my home number. I heard my own voice on the answering machine. Next, I tried Amelia's cell. It went to voicemail after three rings. I was running out of happy options. Figuring that a phone call would be less intrusive than a knock at the door, I tried Trey's number next. I could hear the faint ring of the phone inside, but no one answered it. I called Bill. I didn't think about it for more than a second. I just did it. "Bill Compton," said the familiar, cool voice. "Bill," I said, and then couldn't finish.
"Where are you?"
"I'm sitting in my car outside of Trey Dawson's house."
"The where who owns the motorcycle repair shop?"
"Right."
"I'm coming."
He was there in less than 10 minutes. His car pulled up behind mine. I was pulled over on the shoulder because I hadn't wanted to drive up onto the gravel in front of the house. "I'm weak," I said when he got in beside me. "I shouldn't have called you, but I swear to God I didn't know what else to do."
"You didn't call Eric."
It was a simple observation. "Take too long," I said. I told him what I'd done. "I can't believe I forgot Amelia," I said, stricken by my self-centeredness.
"I think forgetting one thing after such a day is actually permissible, Sookie,"
Bill said. "No, it isn't," I said. "It's just that I can't go in there and find them dead. I just can't do it. My courage has just collapsed." He leaned over and kissed me on the cheek.
"What's one more dead person to me?"
he said. And then he was out of the car and moving silently in the faint light peeking around the curtains of the house next door. He got to the front door, listened intently, He didn't hear anything I knew because he opened the door and stepped inside. Just as he vanished, my cell phone rang. I jumped so hard I almost hit my head on the roof. I dropped the phone and had to grope for it.
Hello?
I said, full of fear.
Hey, did you call? I was in the shower,
Amelia said, and I collapsed over the steering wheel, thinking,
thank you, God, thank you, God, thank you, thank you.
You okay? Amelia asked.
Yes, I said. I'm okay.
Where's Trey? Is he there with you?
Nope. I went to his house, but he wasn't there. I waited a while for you, but you didn't show, so I figured he'd gone to the doctor, and I decided you must have been held up at work or something. I went back to the insurance agency, and I just got home about 30 minutes ago. What's up?
I'll be there soon, I said. Lock the doors and don't let anyone in.
Doors are locked. No one's knocking, she said.
Don't let me in, I said, unless I give you the password.
Sure, Sookie, she said, and I could tell she thought I'd gone over the edge.
What's the password?
Fairy pants, I said,
and how I came up with that, I have no idea. It simply seemed super unlikely that anyone else in the world would say it.
I got it, Amelia said. Fairy pants.
Belle was back at the car.
I've got to go, I said, and hung up.
When he opened the door, the dome light showed his face. It looked grim.
He's not there, he said immediately, but there's been a fight.
Blood?
Yes.
Lots?
He could still be alive. From the way it smelled, I don't think it was all his.
My shoulders slumped. I don't know what to do, I confessed, and it felt almost good to say it out loud. I don't know where to go to find him or how to help him. He's supposed to be working as my bodyguard, but he went out in the woods last night and met up with a woman who said she was your new girlfriend. She gave him a drink. It was bad vampire blood, and it made him sick as the flu.
I looked over at Bill.
Maybe she got it from Bubba. I haven't seen him to ask. I'm kind of worried about him.
I knew Bill could see me far more clearly than I could see him. I spread my hands in query. Did he know this woman? Bill looked at me, his mouth curved up in a rather bitter little smile.
I'm not dating anyone, he said.
I decided to completely ignore the emotional slant. I didn't have the time or the energy tonight. I'd been right when I discounted the mysterious woman's identity.
So this was someone who could pretend to be a fang banger, someone convincing enough to overcome Trey's good sense, someone who could put him under a spell so he'd drink the blood.
Bubba doesn't have much good sense at all,
Belle said.
Even though some fairy magic doesn't work on vampires, I don't think he'd be hard to bespell.
Have you seen him tonight?
He came over to my place to put drinks in his cooler, but he seemed weak and disoriented. After he drank a couple of bottles of True Blood, he seemed to be better. The last I saw of him, he was walking across the cemetery toward your house.
I guess we better go there next.
I'll follow you.
Bill went to his own car, and we set off to drive the short distance to my place. But Bill caught the light at the intersection of the highway and Hummingbird Road, and I was ahead of him by quite a few seconds. I pulled up in back of the house, which was well lit. Amelia had never worried about an electric bill in her life. It just made me want to cry sometimes when I followed her around, turning off switch after switch. I got out of the car and hurried for the back steps, all ready to say, "Fairy pants," when Amelia came to the door. Bill would be there in less than a minute, and we could make a plan on how to find Trey. When Bill got there, he'd check on Bubba. I couldn't go out in the woods. I was proud of myself for not rushing into the trees to find the vampire. I had so much to think about that I didn't think about the most obvious danger. There's no excuse for my lack of attention to detail. A woman by herself always has to be alert, and a woman who's had the experiences I've had has extra cause for alarm when blips are on her radar. The security light was still on at the house, and the backyard looked normal, it was true. I had even glimpsed Amelia in the kitchen through a window. I hurried to the back steps, my purse slung over my shoulder, my trowel and water guns inside it, my keys in my hand. But anything can be hiding in the shadows, and it takes only a moment's inattention for a trap to spring. I heard a few words in a language I didn't recognize, but for a second I thought, he's mumbling, and I couldn't imagine what a man behind me would be mumbling, and I was about to put my foot on the first step to the back porch. And then, I didn't know a thing. Chapter 17. I thought I was in a cave. It felt like a cave, cool, damp, and the sound was funny. My thoughts were anything but speedy. However, the sense of wrongness rose to the top of my consciousness with a kind of dismaying certainty. I was not where I was supposed to be, and I shouldn't be wherever I was. At the moment, these seemed like two separate and distinct thoughts. Someone had bopped me on the head. I thought about that. My head didn't feel sore, exactly. It felt thick, as if I had a bad cold and had taken a serious decongestant on top of that. So, I concluded, with all the speed of a turtle, I had been knocked out magically rather than physically. The result was about the same. I felt like hell, and I was scared to open my eyes. At the same time, I very much wanted to know who was in this space with me. I braced myself and made my eyelids open. I caught a glimpse of a lovely and indifferent face, and then my eyelids clamped shut again. They seemed to be operating on their own timetable.
"She's joining us," said someone.
"Good, we can have some fun," said another voice. That didn't sound promising at all. I didn't think the fun was going to be anything I could enjoy, too. I figured I could get rescued any time now, and that would be just fine. But the cavalry didn't ride in. I sighed and forced my eyes open again. This time, the lid stayed apart, and by the light of a torch, a real, honest-to-God flaming wood torch, I examined my captors. One was a male fairy. He was as lovely as Claudine's brother Claude, and just about as charming, which is to say, not at all. He had black hair, like Claude's, and handsome features, and a buff body, like Claude's. But his face couldn't even simulate interest in me. Claude was at least able to fake it when circumstances required that. I looked at kidnapper number two. She hardly seemed more promising. She was a fairy, too, and therefore lovely, but she didn't appear to be any more light-hearted or fun-loving than her companion. Plus, she was wearing a body stocking, or something very like one, and she looked good in it, which in and of itself was enough to make me hate her.
"We have the right woman," Two said. "The vampire-loving whore. I think the one with short hair was a bit more attractive."
"As if any human can truly be lovely," said one.
It wasn't enough to be kidnapped. I had to be insulted, too. Though their words were the last thing in the world I needed to be worrying about, a little spark of anger lit in my chest. "Just keep that up, asshole," I thought. "You just wait till my great-grandfather gets a hold of you." I hoped they hadn't hurt Amelia or Bubba. I hoped Bill was all right. I hoped he'd called Eric and my great-grandfather. That was a lot of hoping. As long as I was in the wishful thinking zone, I wished that Eric was tuned in to my very great distress and my very real fear. Could he track me by my emotions? That would be wonderful, because I was certainly full of them. This was the worst fix I'd ever been in. Years ago, when Bill and I had exchanged blood, he told me he'd be able to find me. I hoped he'd been telling the truth, and I hoped that ability hadn't faded with time. I was willing to be saved by just about anybody. Soon. Kidnapper Juan slid his hands under my armpits and yanked me to a sitting position. For the first time, I realized my hands were numb. I looked down to see they were tied with a strip of leather. Now I was propped up against a wall, and I could see I was not actually in a cave. We were in an abandoned house. There was a hole in the roof, and I could see stars through it. The smell of mildew was strong, almost choking, and under it trailed the scents of rotting wood and wallpaper. There was nothing in the room but my purse, which had been tossed into a corner, and an old framed photograph, which hung crookedly on the wall behind the two fairies. The picture had been taken outside, probably in the 1920s or 30s, and it was of a black family dressed up for their picture-taking adventure. They looked like a farming family. At least I was still in my own world, I figured, though probably not for long. While I could, I smiled at Thing One and Thing Two.
"My great-grandfather is going to kill you," I said. I even managed to sound pretty happy about that. "You just wait."
One laughed, tossing his black hair behind him in a male modelly gesture. "He'll never find us. He'll yield and step down rather than see you killed in a slow and painful way. He loves humans." Two said, "He should have gone to the Summerland long ago. Consorting with humans will kill us off even faster than we are dying already. Brendan will seal us off. We'll be safe. Niall is out of date."
Like he'd expired on the shelves or something. "Tell me you have a boss," I said. "Tell me you're not the brains of the operation."
I was sort of aware that I was seriously addled, probably as a result of the spell that had knocked me out, but knowing I wasn't myself didn't seem to stop me talking, which was a pity.
"We owe allegiance to Brendan," one said proudly, as if that would make everything clear to me.
Instead of connecting their words with my great-grandfather's archenemy, I pictured the Brandon I'd gone to high school with, who'd been a running back on the football team. He'd gone to Louisiana Tech and then into the Air Force.
"He got out of the service?" I said.
They stared at me with a total lack of comprehension. I couldn't really fault them for that.
"Service of whom?" asked Two.
I was still blaming her for saying I was a skank, and I decided I wasn't speaking to her.
"So, what's the program?" I asked One.
"We wait to hear from Niall, who will respond to Brendan's demands," he said. "Brendan will seal us all in fairy, and we will never have to deal with your like again."
At the moment, that seemed like an excellent plan, and I was temporarily on Brendan's side.
"So Niall doesn't want that to happen?" I said, trying to keep my voice steady.
"No, he wants to visit the likes of you. While Fenton hid the knowledge of you and your brother, Niall behaved himself. But when we removed Fenton..."
"Bit by bit," said Two, and laughed.
"He was able to find enough information to track you down. And so did we. We found your brother's house one day, and there was a gift outside in a truck. We decided to have some fun with it. We followed your scent to where you work, and we left your brother's wife and the abomination outside for all to see. Now we're going to have some fun with you. Brendan has said we can do with you what we will short of death."
Maybe my slow wits were speeding up a little. I understood that they were enforcers for my great-grandfather's enemy, and that they had killed my grandfather Fenton and crucified poor Crystal.
"I wouldn't if I were you," I said, quite desperately. "Hurt me, that is, because, after all, what if this Brendan doesn't get what he wants? What if Niall wins?"
"In the first place, that's not likely," Thing Two said. She smiled. "We plan to win, and we plan to have a lot of fun, especially if Niall wants to see you. Surely he'll demand proof you're alive before he surrenders. We have to leave you breathing.
But the more terrible your plight, the faster the war will be over.
She had a mouthful of the longest, sharpest teeth I'd ever seen. Some of them were capped with gleaming silver points. It was a ghastly touch. At the sight of those teeth, those awful shining teeth, I threw off the remnants of the magic they'd laid on me, which was a great pity.
I was completely and utterly lucid for the next hour, which was the longest of my life. I found it bewildering and utterly shocking that I could feel such pain and not die of it. I would have been glad to die. I know a lot about humans, since I see into their minds every day, but I didn't know a lot about fairy culture. I had to believe Thing One and Thing Two were in a league of their own. I couldn't imagine that my great-grandfather would have laughed when I began to bleed, and I had to hope that he wouldn't enjoy cutting a human with a knife either, as One and Two did. I'd read books where a person being tortured went somewhere else during the ordeal. I did my best to find somewhere else to go mentally, but I remained right there in the room. I focused on the strong faces of the farming family in the photograph, and I wished it wasn't so dusty so I could see them clearly. I wished the picture was straight. I just knew that good family would have been horrified at what they were witnessing now.
This ends Disc 7. Dead and Gone, Disc 8.
At moments when the fairy duo wasn't hurting me, it was very hard to believe I was awake and that this was really happening. I kept hoping I was suffering through a particularly horrible dream and I would wake from it sooner rather than later. I'd known from a very early age that there was cruelty in the world. Believe me, I'd learned that. But I was still shocked that the things were enjoying themselves. I had no personhood to them, no identity. They were completely indifferent to the plans I'd had for my life, the pleasures I'd hoped to enjoy. I might have been a stray puppy or a frog they'd caught by the creek. I myself would have thought doing these things to a puppy or a frog was horrible.
"Isn't this the daughter of the ones we killed?"
One asked Two while I was screaming.
"Yes, they tried to drive through water during a flood," Two said in a tone of happy reminiscence. "Water, when the man had sky blood,
they thought the iron can would protect them."
"The water spirits were glad to pull them under," One said.
My parents hadn't died in an accident. They'd been murdered. Even through my pain, I registered that, though at the moment it was beyond me to form a feeling about the knowledge. I tried to talk to Eric in my head in the hope he could find me through our bond. I thought of the only other adult telepath I knew, Barry, and I sent him messages, though I knew damn good and well that we were too far away from each other to transmit our thoughts. To my everlasting shame, toward the end of that hour, I even considered trying to contact my little cousin Hunter. I knew, though, that not only was Hunter too young to understand, but also, I really couldn't do that to a child. I gave up hope, and I waited for death. While they were having sex, I thought of Sam and how happy it would make me if I could see him now. I wanted to say the name of someone who loved me, but my throat was too hoarse from screaming. I thought about vengeance. I wanted One and Two to die with a craving that burned through my gut. I hoped someone, any one of my soup friends, Claude and Claudine, Niall, Alcide, Bill, Quinn, Trey, Pam, Eric, Calvin, Jason, would tear these two limb from limb.
Perhaps the other fairies could take the same length of time with them that they were taking with me. One and Two had said that Brendan wanted them to spare me, but it didn't take a telepath to realize they weren't going to be capable of holding off. They were going to get carried away with their fun, as they had with Fintan and Crystal, and there would be no repairing me. I became sure I was going to die. I began to hallucinate. I thought I saw Bill, which made no sense at all. He was in my backyard, probably, wondering where I was. He was back in the world that made sense. But I could swear I saw him creeping up behind the creatures, who were enjoying working with a pair of razor blades. He had his finger over his mouth, as if he were telling me to keep silent. Since he wasn't there, and my throat was too raw to speak anyway, I couldn't even produce a decent scream anymore. That was easy. There was a black shadow following him, a shadow topped with a pale flame. Two jabbed me with a sharp knife she'd just pulled from her boot, a knife that shone like her teeth. They both leaned close to me to drink in my reaction. I could only make a raspy noise. My face was crusted with tears and blood. "Little froggy croaking," one said. "Listen to her. Croak, froggy, croak for us." I opened my eyes and looked into hers, meeting them squarely for the first time in many long minutes. I swallowed and summoned up all my remaining strength. "You're going to die," I said with absolute certainty. But I'd said it before, and they didn't pay any more attention now than they had the first time. I made my lips move up in a smile. The male had just enough time to look startled before something gleaming flashed between his head and his shoulders. Then, to my intense pleasure, he was in two pieces, and I was covered in a wash of fresh red blood. It ran over me, drenching the blood already dried on my skin. But my eyes were clear, so I could see a white hand gripped Two's neck, lifting her, spinning her around, and her shock was intensely gratifying as teeth, almost as sharp as her own, ripped into her long neck. Chapter 18. I wasn't in a hospital, but I was in a bed, not my own, and I was a little cleaner than I had been and bandaged, and in a lot of pain. In fact, a dreadful amount of pain. The part where I was cleaner and bandaged, oh, a wholly desirable state. The other part, the pain, well, that was expected, understandable, and finite. At least no one was trying to hurt me any worse than I'd already been hurt. So I decided I was excellent. I had a few holes in my memory. I couldn't remember what had happened between being in the decrepit shack and being here. I could recall flashes of action, the sound of voices, but I had no coherent narrative to connect them. I remembered One's head becoming detached, and I knew someone had bitten Two. I hoped she was as dead as One, but I wasn't sure. Had I really seen Bill? What about the shadow behind him? I heard a click, click, click. I turned my head very slightly. Claudine, my fairy godmother, was sitting by the bed, knitting. The sight of Claudine knitting was just as surrealistic as the sight of Bill appearing in the cave. I decided to go back to sleep, a cowardly retreat, but I thought I was entitled.
"She's going to be all right," Dr. Ludwig said.
Her head came up past the side of my bed, which told me for sure that I wasn't in a modern hospital bed.
Dr. Ludwig takes care of the cases who can't go to the regular human hospital because the staff would flee screaming at the sight of them, or the lab wouldn't be able to analyze their blood. I could see Dr. Ludwig's coarse brown hair as she walked around the bed to the door. Dr. Ludwig had a deep voice. I suspected she was a hobbit,